Josephine Petrick for Appellant Fred Sahadi. I want to turn first to the issue of grant fees, because the economic reality is that so many of these insurance recovery cases are going to be contingency fee cases. Most insurers trying to chase down their insurers simply don't have the resources to pay for an attorney on an hourly basis, particularly when they were in an accident or other calamity and they're hurting for the insurance proceeds that they contracted for with their insurers. And like this case, many will be at an early stage when the insured may suspect, though perhaps could not yet prove, that the insurer will not be dealing with them fairly and promptly.
I think they may start. If I can ask,
yes.
I acknowledge that you have a very compelling policy argument here in terms of what would happen if this is upheld, and is this going to adversely affect the decision below? Is upheld? Is this going to adversely affect a number of people who make contingency fee arrangements with their counsel and later have to pursue their bad faith claim? But it seems to me, what's difficult about this case is that Brandt seems to be very clear in its holding that attorney's fees are only recoverable as compensatory damages if the insured can show it was reasonably necessary for him to obtain the attorney because of the insurer's bad faith. So how do we resolve this without going in your favor, without going against Brandt?
Yes, Your Honor. In Brandt, I think the portion of Brandt that Your Honor is referring to, the reasonably necessary, certainly is met here for multiple reasons. First, because Mr. Sahadi, or a reasonable jury could find that Mr. Sahadi would have had to retain his counsel eventually in the face of Liberty Mutual's extended delay and foot dragging and paying the fees. But also I think there's an issue here about cause in fact. You know, I think the reasonably necessary requirement of Brandt certainly could be met here. But in terms of the component of proximate cause of loss causation, PPP Industries, one of the California lead cases on loss causation in this context, instructs that there are two components of proximate cause. One is cause in fact, and one is a public policy. And as Your Honor stated, the public policy considerations here are compelling. And here, there is enough evidence that Mr. Sahadi presented at summary judgment to establish cause in fact for several reasons. One is because he said he retained the Shea and Shea firm because Liberty Mutual had a reputation for not timely paying claims. And at that point, even if he could not yet definitively prove or point to a specific date on which Liberty Mutual had begun unreasonably delaying, as trial counsel pinned the date, that would be around, or a reasonable jury could find that was around May 27th, 2016. But this is unlike other contexts, like in the previous case we just heard, securities cases. You'll hear, there is reliance on a statement or reliance on a misstatement by a company executive. You can pinpoint that precise date, and any reliance obviously has to happen after that date. But in this case, there's no reliance on a misstatement. To the contrary, it's where the plaintiff, the insured, correctly anticipates that the insurer will not be dealing with them in a fair and prompt manner. And almost by definition, that is a slow burn. And so here we have, Mr. Sahadi changing his counsel when his first trial counsel, Todd Davis, was not making any headway with Liberty Mutual.
Can I ask a question right there, just to make sure I understand your full answer to Judge Murguia's question? When he changed counsel, did the fee percentage increase? Wasn't it one-third?
Not, I do not believe.
So you're not relying on the change in counsel to increase his fee obligation, is that right? Have I got that?
No, Your Honor. No.
Thank you. Go right ahead.
Okay, yeah, and as I read the record, I think a reasonable jury could find that the only fees that Mr. Sahadi is seeking is the $160,000 in change. That's the 33% of his recovery. That's what he paid the Shea and Shea firm. And so a reasonable jury could find that Todd Davis's fees are not included in that sum. But I think
Can I ask you about the public policy question? So I appreciate the fact that if there's a rule that you really cannot get contingency fees until there is some clear evidence of bad faith, why is an alternative, this scenario, not possible? That is, a person signs a contingency arrangement. I know there's some technical problems with this, but signs a contingency agreement, not knowing whether there's going to be an exercise of bad faith by the insurance company, but then you can identify a time at which bad faith happens. And so therefore, the role of the attorney shifts from one of general defense to one of defense in regard to bad faith. And as a result, with some rough accounting, one could assess a certain amount of the contingency fee to response to an insurance company's bad faith. And so therefore, you would have still the proximate causation to that particular amount of the fee, although it would not be the entire contingency fee. I know there's some difficulties in lawyers keeping track of their hours, et cetera, but still, what about that as a possible scenario so that the right to counsel is not impacted by our decision?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that is a possibility, and I do think that the Kasem Court presents an analogous scenario in, you know, dividing fees between those that are used to chase the benefits of the contract and then those which are used or that are incurred in connection with a bad faith case. The Kasem Court there said that that's going to be a question for the jury, is dividing up those fees. And so I think, you know, that could potentially be a response, a solution to the public policy dilemma presented here. But I still think that would not be a barrier to recovery. That would not be a reason to grant summary judgment in this case. Did I hear a question?
No, but I have one. Pursuant to Brandt, were you seeking a recovery of fees and costs?
Yes, Your Honor, fees and costs.
Okay, in that case, I have a follow-up question, because the district court decided, you just had to decide that, as you said, there's proximate, that these attorney's fees were approximate and direct result of the bad faith, mm-hmm. right? And an attorney fee, a contingency fee agreement makes this really tough for all the reasons you've explained, I think, very articulately. It's one-third. It's a sort of an all or nothing. But that's not true of cost. Cost keeps just continuing to mount along. So I'm concerned about whether you think that, and this is really for both counsel, whether the district court's ruling is overly broad. Even if we were to agree that one-third contingency fee was incurred, if you will, before there was an allegation of bad faith, what about the fact that at some point, if you weren't able to show, you know, that there was bad faith 1 year in, right, and costs continued to amount for the next year, wouldn't it be entirely consistent that we would draw a line in the sand and say, well, those costs out there after bad faith were directly and proximately caused by the bad faith?
Yes, Your Honor. And I do think that the district court's opinion was overly broad in that sense, because, you know, I haven't exactly done the math, but approximately half of the fees were incurred before this, you know, bright line date that trial counsel pointed to.
You just said fees. I'm talking about cost. Did you mean?
Oh,
I want to make sure we're communicating. Okay.
Yes,
well,
did
the district court have that showing that costs were incurred over she's not clairvoyant. I don't think we have it in our record. But did she have an indication that the cost at what point the costs had accrued? You know, an itemized list.
Yes, Your Honor. And if I may briefly pull up the record.
Feel free to correct me if I don't want to take up all your time, but maybe when you come back, if you could just give me the ER site, that would be helpful.
Okay. I'll do that. The short answer is that's absolutely correct. And there is an itemized list of costs in the record. It reflects that approximately half the costs, at least in terms of number, were incurred before that May 27th, 2016 date. But at least half of them, or, you know, the remaining half, were incurred after that, including Fred Sahadi's deposition, requests for medical records that Liberty Mutual had requested late in the day, that sort of thing. Those are all costs incurred after that, we'll call it that bright line date. So I do think the district court overstepped or that the ruling was overbroad in that sense, because as Your Honor noted, costs were not contingent necessarily. And so they were certainly, you know, incurred on a particular, on a date certain. Liberty Mutual responded to that argument saying, well, all of those costs, and this was in the district court's opinion as well, all of those costs after that date were incurred in connection with an arbitration that Sahadi himself requested. I don't think that's, for one thing, I don't think that's the case with all of those costs. I think they use the term most of them. Some of them were medical requests for medical records and whatnot. But even if it were an arbitration that Sahadi himself requested, he would not have had to, or a reasonable jury could find, that he would not have had to request that arbitration had Liberty Mutual paid in a timely manner. And indeed, the record reflects that the arbitration, at least formally, did not initiate until January of 2017, I believe.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, with respect to the bad faith, which is, I think, where you were headed.
That's where I was heading.
Which facts of Liberty Mutual's investigation, in your view, give rise to the strongest inference that the insurance company here, the investigation was unreasonable? And what was your, I kind of wanted to know what your best authority is for supporting that inference.
Oh, certainly. Well, first I want to look at the timing. I mean, from the time of the accident, certainly, and of course that's not where we'd necessarily draw the line, but just to frame it a little bit, the accident occurred in, you know, February of 2015, and Mr. Sahadi did not see a dime of insurance proceeds as compensatory damages for his UIM claim until February of 2017. But we would, you know, his trial counsel.
If you go from the time of the accident, I mean, right. There were like 7 months there that was was not the insurance fault. I mean, I think we're kind of looking at the 9 to 10 months after the initial demand. Would you agree with me on that?
Yes, Your Honor. You know, just to frame it a little bit, how long he had to wait in terms of injuries. It had already been that long, and you know, we're not attributing that time to Liberty Mutual, but starting on the date. April 12, 2016, when Mr. Sahadi's trial counsel, or you know, his counsel at Shea & Shea, provided the demand package, you know, with all of the information that he thought Liberty Mutual would potentially request, and I know there were some follow-up requests for information, but 4,600 pages of medical records, at least three statements by before and after witnesses attesting to Mr. Sahadi's change in state.
But counsel, could I stop you? Your time's ticking, and we know it's a lot. But that's exactly why it takes the insurance company a while to digest it. It's 4,600 pages. Judge Murguia is right. It took them a long time to get plaintiff's counsel to respond. I appreciate you've conceded that point. So on April 14th, right, there's the demand, 4,600 pages, right? April 21, they retained this nurse to look at everything. And at that point, I don't want to take up too much of your time, or the panels, but after that point, how is it that the insurance company delayed in reviewing and evaluating the claim once they had it? Because I think on April 14th, they had it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Your Honor. And I do, if possible, I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal, but I do want to make sure I answer that question because I do think it's an important one.
It's an important one. What's your answer?
Yeah. So there was a 3-month delay. You know, there were several periods of delay. And the first I would point to the 3-month, 4-day delay between July 20th and October 24th, 2016, during which time a reasonable jury could find that there was no adjusting activity whatsoever. I know Crump testified that, you know, it was so Schwartz, Schwartz made his last notation in the record on July 20th. I think I'm losing sound here. Can you hear
Schwartz
me?
Okay. Left July 23rd, okay. And you're saying that there's nothing. Mm-hmm. So then there's, right, the new adjuster was assigned August 2nd.
Yes, and yeah, the new adjuster Crump did not make any notation whatsoever in the file, and there was no correspondence either until October 24th, 2016. So that's a 3-month delay, and that's on top of the delay that totaled, you know, between this May 27th, 2016 date and the date of the settlement, was 9 months and 27 days. That's, you know, an insurer has 3 options when they get a demand under the California Code of the insurance regulations. They can pay the claim, they can deny the claim, or they can ask for more information within 40 days. And they have to support, they have to explain why they need that information. The one thing they can't do is take a break. They can't just take a break, and especially they can't take a break when they know that their insured is elderly. He was in his 80s. He was suffering from daily pain. He's on pain medications.
Counsel, and I'm going to interrupt you to make sure I get the answer to the question. You're pointing to unreasonable delay between July 20th and October 4th.
Yes.
Okay. 24th, do you have another period of delay? I just want to make sure I got it.
Yes, and then that period, that 3-month period, is surrounded by a longer period of delay between May 27th, 2016, when the demand expired.
Okay.
And February 8th, 2017.
So can I ask you about the disclosure? I appreciate that 4,600 pages was disclosed, but essentially you know that the position of the insurance company was that they needed to explore whether, in fact, there was a pre-existing condition, and that there was a real question as to the cause of his problems, the medical problems, and relating that to the accident. So one of the major disclosures that was made to you were the MRIs, because the MRIs were then given to radiologists by the insurance company, who then confirmed their theory that this was all pre-existing condition. My question is, when did the MRIs come to you? Because clearly the insurance company has the right to explore this particular issue as to whether there is a pre-existing condition. When did it come to you? And it's unclear why the MRIs were not part of the original 4,600 pages, et cetera. Do you know anything about that?
Your Honor, I do not think that the record reflects when Mr. Sahadi's counsel received the MRIs, but I believe the correspondence reflects that they shared everything they had. Sorry, there's a bit of an echo, but the correspondence reflects that they shared everything they had. And then obtain the, a jury could probably infer that they obtained the MRI from the original MRIs in response to his request. But I do want to emphasize something that also.
Okay, I want to make sure that's accurate. I mean, essentially, the MRIs of the spine go right to the heart of what the insurance company was investigating. I just don't understand why those MRIs, if conducted earlier, had not been shared with the insurance company until I thought it was after October. This was very short before the initial settlement. Do you know when the MRIs were shared with them? And do you know the story about how those MRIs were recovered and then the decision made to share them with the insurance company?
Your Honor, the timeline that I believe is reflected in the record. So the record does not reflect the story behind, you know, obtaining the MRIs. I think the correspondence between the parties reflects that Sahadi's trial counsel, O'Connor, Mr. O'Connor, shared everything he had in the 4,600 pages. And then the MRIs were provided on request when Liberty Mutual had questions. And that was after Nurse Kroger had reviewed the 4,600 pages, which really didn't take her that long, took her maybe a month or two, I believe, And she, Liberty Mutual's own retained nurse, Nurse Kroger, said that, well, the neck pain is it's a new problem. It certainly appears as though Mr. Sahadi's spine issues were aggravated after the accident. And Mr. Sahadi's trial counsel made very clear that this was not an acute injury case. This was a case where, you know, to use his metaphor, where one domino fell and the rest of his degeneration became worse as a result. Almost like,
okay, but certainly in light of what the insurance company was doing, looking into his spinal pre-existing condition, those, you would acknowledge that those MRIs of the spine are essentially the most important medical records in this particular case. And if those were not shared with the insurance company until at least October, it may have been November, it may have been December, it may have been within, you know, a month or two of the settlement, doesn't that bear some weight on your bad faith claim?
Your Honor, I would submit that a reasonable jury could disagree. A reasonable jury could look at the fact that Liberty Mutual's first medical expert, Nurse Kroger, recognized that it was a new problem based on the records, and that there was an aggravation of the spinal condition and its overall condition, and the fact that Liberty Mutual immediately changed its position after it finally deposed Mr. Sahadi nearly 2 years after the accident and said, well, he's sympathetic, he's believable, we better pay policy limits. And they agreed to pay the very next day within an hour. And so I think, you know, we could sit here and deliberate about, you know, how important were those records? Maybe should they have been provided earlier? How reasonable was this delay? How reasonable was it to retain those additional experts who didn't actually examine Mr. Sahadi? But I would submit that whether there's a genuine dispute, whether there is a genuine dispute, and that should be for the jury to deliberate on.
I have a question, right? Just yes, no. Mm-hmm. In April 14th, when the 4,600 pages were delivered, was a signed medical release also delivered to Liberty?
I believe that was provided shortly thereafter. I want to say a month later. I don't think so, but I will get back to you. Yeah.
All right. So my yes, no is not sure. Got it. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll give you a couple minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Booth, please state your appearance.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Nicholas Bose for Liberty Mutual Fire Insurance Company. And I will begin by talking about Brandt as well. And Brandt is very clear about the proximate causation requirement and the conditions under which attorney's fees are potentially recoverable in an insurance bad faith case. Brandt emphasized many times that they're only recoverable as a damage, analogizing to a case of personal injury where medical expenses would be recoverable as a proximate cause of an event. That same way, it said that attorney's fees can be recoverable, but only where the bad faith causes the insured to incur the attorney's fees.
So why not the costs in this case?
I'm sorry?
So why aren't the costs? I think you did a really nice job in the briefing, and I understand your contingency fee argument, although it's tough. The fallout is tough, given that in these cases, contingency fees are ubiquitous. But that is what it is. Could you focus on the question about cost?
Sure. The costs are not recoverable for a few different reasons, independent reasons. First, some of them were incurred, again, prior to the date that the plaintiff alleged that the bad faith began. That is, they were incurred prior to May 27, 2016. So you have the same...
Right, but some were not, and that's what I'm focusing on.
Okay, and then you have others that were incurred as part of the arbitration that was demanded by Mr. Sahadi. And when he submitted his demand, his claim to the company, he demanded an arbitration at that very same time. So costs that were incurred by him in connection with that arbitration that he demanded and that he insisted go forward many, many times were not caused by any bad faith, but by his own demand for arbitration.
Well, regardless of the forum used to resolve the dispute, a mediation, an arbitration, a trial, his point is, I think, once you had all the information, you know, even if Brandt is read to exclude anything that I would have had to incur anyway, that regardless of the forum used to resolve the dispute, those other costs I shouldn't have had to incur. What's wrong with that?
But because he needs to show why he should not have had to incur them, and he didn't do that. And that brings me to another waiver.
Well, his argument's going to be, well, because you didn't pay. You had everything you needed. You had, I think, although I have a question for you about whether you had a signed medical release. And then at some point it was just too long. So why is that not right? Why couldn't a jury agree with that?
With respect to costs in particular, from the general issue of whether there was an unreasonable withholding of benefits, if he's going to claim specific cost items, he needs to explain why each specific cost item was incurred as a result of bad faith, as opposed to being incurred as a result of a reasonable aspect of an investigation. Counsel just conceded that there were reasonable follow-up requests. So he's got to show why, if a cost was incurred as part of responding to a reasonable follow-up request, why should that be included as part of a recoverable Brandt cost? And counsel did, and Mr. Plaintiff didn't do that. And he waived that issue down at the district court and waived it again here by not raising it in the papers.
Let's focus on this policy argument, if you don't mind, Mr. Bowes, because this is, you know, gives me some pause here. I understand, you know, what Brandt says, but if we were to affirm the district court's Brandt's analysis here and hold that Sahadi is not entitled to attorney's fees under Brandt because he can't show the requisite causation like we've been talking about, does that, if we find that here, does that preclude all future insureds from recovering attorney's fees, no matter how egregious the insurer's conduct is? You know, if the insured proactively hires the attorney to help them through the claims process?
Well, it depends, Your Honor, on the facts of each different case. And so the main point is...
Well, I guess, do you think that's the result the California Supreme Court intended in Brandt?
I think...
Because there's a lot of language also, you know, including in CASM, which came after Brandt, which is a contingency fee case that kind of underscores that Brandt's premise was to recover as tort damages the legal fees incurred to recover their policy benefits so that the burden of attorney's fees does not diminish the insurer's compensatory award. So I'm just trying to reconcile what they seem to be protecting, which I think we have to do is try to predict what the California Supreme Court would do here, what they seem to be protecting versus, you know, some possible conflicting or inconsistent language regarding the fees.
Well, I think that the Brandt court was very specific about the requirement that it was only awarding those as tort damages. And so the situation, to your point, I mean, I think I understand your concern, and I analogize it to another insurance principle in California, which is where there is no coverage under a policy, even if the insurer acted unreasonably in its investigation and did all these things, there is no cause of action for bad faith. So it's not that there's no remedy in that situation for...
Well, what is the remedy then? Well, what is the remedy?
Well, there's no harm. There's no harm caused to the insured. So the insured is not able to collect any damages because there are no damages. But there are other options for reporting the insurer to the Department of Insurance, or potential other cause of action.
Well, why shouldn't we find that Sahadi is entitled to Brandt fees if he can show that he would have eventually had to retain an attorney to recover the benefits?
Because that's not how proximate causation works in California. He's got to show that he would not have incurred those attorney fees except for the insurance company's bad faith. And that's just not the case. He was not out of pocket at all because of this alleged bad faith.
All right, so then let's just assume that Sahadi's counsel was retained on an hourly rate and that Liberty Mutual began acting in bad faith in let's say, May of 2016. Under Brandt, could Sahadi recover the fees incurred after Liberty Mutual began acting in bad faith, or does that bad faith have to be the reason that Sahadi retained the counsel?
No, I think in that situation where he potentially could be able to recover those fees that were incurred after the date the bad faith began.
I have two follow-up questions on this point, but I don't want to interrupt you. Judge McKee's got it.
Go ahead, Chris.
I just want to kind of poke at this a little bit. I tried a lot of these cases, and I don't think I ever had one where I didn't have a physician come in and say, well, as we age, we get degenerative disc disease. And so to follow up on Judge McKee's point about why couldn't he show that he would have had to retain counsel, I mean, I have a really detailed timeline, as you do, I'm sure, and for the first many months, plaintiff's counsel, not present company excluded, was not responsive, okay? But why couldn't a jury look at this and hear this evidence and understanding that I think it would be likely there would be an expert who would say, as we age, we get degenerative disc disease, and these are the kinds of signs, you know, we see on films. So taking that together with after your team had everything, then there's an expert that starts to say, well, right, the images didn't show any changes caused by the accident. And in fact, it seems to me that, you know, sort of the gestalt is that these films were really unremarkable and entirely consistent with all of it, what's happening to my spine right now as I sit here and yours as you sit there, and decide they were just stalling. That's my one question. And you know, I couple that with, we've pushed pretty hard on a plaintiff's counsel to say, where's the unreasonable delay? And she's pointed out a pretty discreet period on the timeline here and says what they can't do under California law is nothing. You know, take a break, I think was her position. And she mentioned, I think she said a 40-day limit or guideline where insurance companies are supposed to respond. And what they were getting in sort of June, July, August, and the fall of 2016 was delay because, an expert wants to decide if these films are meaningful or not. This is a very kind of, I don't even know what my question is. But I'm concerned about putting those two factors together. Why couldn't a jury just say they were stalling their feet and at some point that's bad faith?
Because of the nature of the...
Did I say stalling their feet? I meant dragging their feet. Sorry. Go right ahead.
Understood. And the answer, Your Honor, is because of the nature of the claims... injury and the nature of the claimed symptoms, you have complex questions of what's causing these symptoms, what's causing these injuries. So part of looking at the history of the spine is to determine, is this something, the symptoms that are being claimed, is this something that is the result of something that pre-existed, a condition that pre-existed the accident, such that the symptoms really attributed to the pre-existing condition and not the accident?
Right, except that the nurse had been through the 4,600 pages, and at that point, because you had him as of April, and it seems like, rather than just saying it could be, of course it could be pre-existing, but after you've gone through the records and nobody's pointing to anything, right, then...
Well, actually, when the nurse went through the records, she identified many, many pre-existing issues, including spinal degeneration and stenosis noted in 2015, 2013... a reference to a neurosurgeon referral in 2005, which caused the insurance company to want that record.
Yes, except that what you're talking about, that's the, just to be clear, I know I'm interrupting, forgive me, but her responses are what I'm referring to in my question, which it seems entirely what I've heard in so many of these trials, same old, there's some degenerative disease. Yes, there is with all of us as we age. So did she point to something other than the aging process?
You mean an acute injury?
Right. What is there? It seems it's just entirely unremarkable to me. Was there could a jury decide that there wasn't really a good faith reason to think that something really was pre-existing?
No, I think your question is the point. Why they need to look at it to see, because, for example, if there is no acute injury, but then they go and get the MRIs that show there was acute injury, like some acute change, sudden change on January 19, 2015, then they say, okay, well, maybe these claimed symptoms really were the result of the accident. So you don't know. It's just an effort to collect information in order to determine one way or the other, you know, because the MRIs could show that his claimed symptoms are the result of the accident.
Opposing counsel said you can't take a break and that there's a some kind of rule or ethical standard, professional standard in California about 40 days. I can you respond to that?
Well, I think that, yes, the statement I think was in the context of the assertion that between sometime in July and sometime in October, there was a delay. But the record shows that at that time, the parties were both represented by counsel, engaged in discovery in the arbitration, exchanging discovery. And at the very same time, Mr. Crump, who had taken over the file, was reviewing the 4,600 pages of documents. And at the result of his review of those documents, then continued with the evaluation and the adjustment. So there was no break. It was just, you know, there was the arbitration going on at that time that had been demanded. But the rule though in California is the insurance company absolutely is able to continue to investigate and adjust the claim and does not need to come to a decision within 40 days. There's no hard and fast rule on that. It's just whatever a reasonable investigation period takes. And I submit that the record here shows that there was absolutely a reasonable investigation. There certainly was not any conduct that meets the standard of bad faith, which is a conscious and deliberate act.
So can I just ask you, oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'll wait. Go ahead, Joseph.
So can you just explain to me the MRIs and when they came and the significance of those MRIs to your ultimate decisions?
The MRIs were not part of the original submission in April 2016. They were, I believe, identified by the nurse during her review as something that should be requested. They were requested by Liberty right after that. They were received...
June 21.
They were received by June 21, 2016. Then they were sent to a radiologist for review. The radiologist provided a report in early July 2016, which showed no acute injury, which caused Liberty to say, you know, we can't conclude that your claim is worth $485,000, like you say it is.
Thank you.
I have another aspect on whether the investigation was fair and reasonable with respect to whether, you know, there's a tribal issue of fact. So let me just ask you, you know, could a reasonable jury infer from the undisputed facts in this case that Liberty Mutual's investigation was unreasonable because Liberty Mutual ignored evidence that Sahadi's quality of life worsened as a result of the accident and focused only, or certainly primarily, on its perceived defense that Sahadi's spinal injury that needed surgery was not caused by the accident? Because I know there's some case law that maybe not support the insurance company on this. So I just wanted to give you an opportunity to respond.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I think the record shows that there really aren't any material facts in dispute here. And the record shows an objective view of the entire record, which is how the bad faith is looked at, shows that the investigation was entirely reasonable. And the fact that Mr. Sahadi claimed to be in pain, certainly that goes to the question of whether the value of his claim is $485,000. But again, that goes to the question of whether it was caused by the accident or something else. So the insurance company needs to conduct an investigation in order to determine these things, and it conducted a reasonable one here.
Yeah, but it seemed like the insurance company was really focused on the spinal injury and that needed, trying to defend whether or not, Sahadi's spinal injury, whether it needed the surgery. And it seemed like he was also complaining of the pain and everything, his quality of life before and after the accident. And case Mariscal, seems to indicate that, when an insurance company's investigation doesn't focus on everything and just on certain things, that may create a tribal issue of fact. And I just wanted to give you an opportunity to respond to that.
Thank you. The evidence here shows that Liberty Mutual did consider everything. And that's evidenced by the fact that they paid the $485,000 policy limit despite consulting experts opining that what he was claiming was not caused by the accident. And in the course of coming up with their valuation, the evidence shows that they considered the letters that were provided by the insured's treating physicians and weighed all of the evidence. They put all of the information together, determined a valuation range, and ultimately paid the limit, even though it was on the very, very high end of that range. So it's not a situation where some cases talk about an insurer that myopically focuses on obtaining evidence to disprove a claim. That was not the situation here. The situation here, the record shows, was that the insurer was simply trying to gather all of the facts so that it could determine a valuation range, both good and bad.
Was there some revelation? This is a lot of money. And then there was another for this type of damage, type of accident. And then there was another, very large recovery. So it just begs the question, and you're way over time, but was there some revelation at this deposition that doesn't come through in our record here? Other than that, he was very believable and sympathetic.
It was the deposition, and combined with everything else, was the conclusion that, that led them to conclude that it could be worth the policy limit. But they certainly, their valuation range was between approximately $350,000 and approximately $490,000.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chessis, do you have another question for Mr. Bose?
No, thank you.
All right. Ms. Patrick, you were way over time. I'll just give you 2 minutes to give your final rebuttal. I'm sorry, you're muted.
I said, thank you, I appreciate it. on the bad faith issue, I would push back against the representation that Mr. Crump reviewed the file, because the record reflects from Mr. Crump's deposition, he said those 4,600 some odd pages, I did not review those, 386 to 387, that at a minimum creates a genuine issue as to whether those documents were reviewed, whether that time was necessary to review those documents, especially given that the nurse already summarized them. And in terms of, Your Honor, Judge Murguia asked about leading authorities for, the bad faith and the genuine dispute. I would agree that Mariscal is a very good case, and I would also point to Brame and Fadif, all cases where, the insurer retained experts, but there was still a genuine dispute as to the reasonableness of their investigation. And then I did want to follow up with some of the record sites that we discussed in the opening. I agree that the MRIs were shared late June of 2016. And that is also when the post-accident, when the release was shared. That was June 23rd, 2016.
Do you have an ER site for that?
Yes, Your Honor, 4ER721.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that was shortly after the demand package, and I believe it was within 2 weeks of Liberty Mutual's request. And finally, the place in the record where that itemizes the costs, the grant costs and expenses, 4ER824-825, that's itemized and dated expenses. If Your Honors have any other questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Which sessions?
No, thank you.
Just Kristen.
No, thank you both.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Bose, I know we asked a lot of questions in this challenging case. We appreciate your arguments here very much. Thank you. The case of Fred Sahadi versus Liberty Mutual Insurance is submitted.